got in the cab wreck, I said, day before yesterday. And I said, where'd you train? I said, I knew that his club was down in down in Florida somewhere, so the Red Sox. So anyway, I said, I trained in Arizona. And he said, I'm sorry to hear you got those bad ribs. I said, yeah. And he got down real, real good for me. Hell of a guy, Sullivan. Yeah, he owns half the club now.
Are there any particular calls that you remember making on the field?
Yeah, I remember. I remember making a call for a guy that was about to lose his job, that I blew the call on purpose. Now, it's hard to say this, but I'm going to tell you the truth. This guy's name was Bill Brenner. He became a war hero. In the Second World War, he was an aviator. Well, he's managing the Vancouver Ball Club. And Vancouver had a... They were about third place all the time. So during the Second World War, I go in the office to get the baseballs in our mail. Baseballs were hard to get in those days. He used to wash the balls, by the way, Bob Brown, that owned the ball club. And he says, I got to do an awful thing tonight, John. I said, what's that, Mr. Brown? He says, I have to fire Bill Brenner. I said, Jesus, Mr. Brown. I said, great guy, Bill Brenner. He's a nice guy. He said, yeah, he's a nice guy. He said, he's never been kicked out of a ball game. He's been with me 3 years. That don't make him a bad manager. Yeah, but he's not fiery enough. He said, I should be in second place instead of third place. So, and that happened to be Penticton night. Penticton is where they raised apricots. And the park, standing room only crowd, and they had about 10 cowgirls passing out apricots to all the fans. So I go to my dressing room, and the guy that I was working with that year was a guy named Harry Ornst. Harry Ornst, he owned the St. Louis Blues hockey team later. Mm-hmm. He owned the Toronto, he just sold the Toronto Argonauts and played football. Good umpire and a good guy. And we had kids that we'd let in the ballpark and give them a couple of bucks. They'd shine our shoes and they'd take care of us, get the dirt for our baseballs. And I sent one of the kids in their dressing room and tell Mr. Brenner I want to talk to him. So Bill comes to the door and I said, Bill, come on in, I want to talk to you. He said, no, I'm not allowed in your dressing room. I says, you are if you're invited. I was supposed to be umpire in chief those last 2 years there, you know. So he come in and I told him, I said, Bill, I says, you're married, you got a family. I says, you're about to get to Evo. I said, you've never been running a ball game. I said, tonight I want to run you. I said, the first close play, I want you to come charging. And he said, I don't want to do that. Bill's a pretty big guy. Big. He was 6'2", weighed about 210. He was a pitcher and a catcher at one time. And I don't want to do that. I said, you got to do it. I said, otherwise your job is, you're in trouble. Sure enough, here comes the play at second base, and I booted the play. The game was kind of lopsided. It was maybe 8-2 at the time. Here he comes, charging like a bull. And I draw a line, and he steps over the line and bumps me, so I give him the heave-ho, and all the Canadians. And they were getting beat, by the way, Vancouver. And here comes the apricots. They were really throwing apricots, and they sting, you know. Oh, they hurt. So anyway, that saved Bill's job. Later on, he became, he managed Seattle for about a year, year and a half. And then he became general manager of Sacramento in the Coast League. Died here about 3 years ago. Great guy, Bill Brenner.
Of course, at that time, there weren't four managers on the field, were there?
No. What do you mean four managers?
Four umpires. Right?
No. We were in the Western International League, we only worked with two. In the Coast League, we worked with two and three. And you really had to hustle with two umpires. You had to cover that field like a blanket, otherwise you're in a lot of trouble. And the lights in some of those parks in the WI League, I remember one night in Yakima, you couldn't see the right fielder. And up in Victoria, once we got fogged out, there was so much fog. But I remember in Yakima, this outfielder carried a ball in his back pocket. A guy hit one out of the park, the guy makes a big jump like he caught the ball in the right fielder, like he caught the ball, and he pulls the ball out of his pocket and throws it in, bang him out, and what the hell, nobody knew. The umpires, we didn't know, you know. So So here comes the guy. He says, well, here's the ball that Zeke hit, or somebody, I forget who the hell hit it. But he says, that ball went out of the park. Half the spectators didn't know. Some of them didn't know, you know, that it went out. But it favored Yakima, so everything was all right. Otherwise, we'd have got killed, I guess.
Were there any parks that you remember that were particularly good, especially in the later years in the Pacific Coast League?
Yeah, I thought that Wrigley Field in L.A. was a good park. I thought that Gilmore Field in Los Angeles was a lousy park. I thought the park in San Diego was right on the waterfront. That was a bad park. Vaughn Street Park in Portland was a bad park, and then they moved later on to Multnomah. That wasn't a bad park. Multnomah Stadium was really a football field. Sixth Stadium was as good a park as you wanted to see in minor league baseball.
Were there any sections of particular stadiums that are memorable, like the wall in Fenway or the ivy-covered wall in Wrigley?
Well, yeah, at Vaughn Street, they had at left field, they had some kind of a shack out there for their tools or something. And
where was that?
That was in Vaughn Street in Portland.
Portland,
yeah. And the foul line wasn't painted too good out there, so I remember a ball that I didn't know whether it's fair or foul. I got to call it. I got to make a decision. I got to guess. And if you guess wrong, you're in trouble. If you guess against the home team, you're in trouble. I guessed against the home team, and all hell broke loose. And that was a tough spot for all umpires, but on account of that's no line prop, and that and a little shed out there, not a proper line. That was a bad ballpark, but it seated about 25,000 people. So I remember years ago, they used to have the Shaughnessy playoff in the Coast League. You know what the Shaughnessy playoff is? First four teams play for the pennant. Oakland and Portland are tied for the Coast League. They're playing in Portland, 25,000 seats, all filled. Manager of Oakland at that time was Mel Ott. Bill Sweeney had Portland. Red Adams is pitching for Portland. Johnny Vandermeer just came down from the big leagues. He's pitching for Oakland, and he was having a good year. My turn to work behind the plate. And that night, the night before the ball game, after all the season is over, the next day, they had a club down in Portland called Amato's. It was a bottle club. Nice club. And the bartender, we'd leave him a couple of passes for the ball games, and he'd always give us a belt out of some guy's bottle and relax a little bit. So, I was going there that night. Here, it's my turn to work the plate, and I'm going to be careful. I'm not drinking too much, but I had a couple of belts, and I see Bill Sweeney dead drunk trying to watch the floor show over in the corner on some table, and he's trying to peek at the floor show, but I don't want him to see me, so I walk around, and no way he could see me. So anyway, the next day at the ballpark here, the park is jammed, and a real, real hot day, and Mel Ott's over here, and Sweeney's over here with the lineups. How do you feel? It's fine, Mr. Sweeney. How are you? Well, I want you to know I saw you last night. He says, you better be bearing down. I said, Mr. Sweeney, I'm always bearing down. And Mel Ott's trying to figure out what the hell we were talking about. And that ball game goes 14 innings. Vandermeer allowed three hits up to the ninth. Red Adams about four or five hits. In the 14th inning, Frankie Austin, he was playing short for Portland at that time. The first hitter was a guy named Harvey Story. He hits a triple off of Vandermeer in the 14th inning. Frankie Austin is the next hitter. Vandermeer strikes out Austin. Austin was playing short for Oakland, pardon me. So anyway, he strikes out the next guy, and the next ball is hit to the shortstop, which was Frankie Austin playing for Oakland. And they got Story in a rundown. Third and the plate, third in the plate, third in the plate. Finally, Vandermeer's covering the plate with the ball in his hand, tags him, drops the ball. He gets beat 1-0. He took his glove and he sailed it out of the park. And can you imagine losing a ball game to this tomato-faced son of a bitch? That's what he hated, Sweetie, you know. And losing a ball game like this, he says, of all the ball games I wanted to win, he says, even the World Series, he says, I wanted to win this one because when I got out of the bigs, I had some people, relatives living in Portland, and he wouldn't sign me. And he said, I wanted to beat that tomato son of a bitch, he says. And he was a hell of a pitcher. That day he was great. Yeah, that was one of the toughest ones I had.
Talking of Johnny Vandermeer, did you ever umpire behind the plate for a no-hitter?
Yeah, I had a couple of no-hitters. I had them in the service, though. I had an 18-inning ball game in Salem. One of the writers down there that used to be a ball player, he became a hell of a writer down in this the hell did they call that paper in Salem? The Statesman. This guy was Al Leitner. He's getting married. They were supposed to have a doubleheader, and they were supposed to have a wedding between games. They're playing Spokane. And first game goes 18 innings, and finally Speed Jolly breaks up the ball game. Now they had to start the second game because they advertised a doubleheader. And anyway, Leitner got married between games, and we only threw one pitch in the second game. But that was a tough one, too. It was all good pitching. They used about three pitchers apiece. Yeah, the pitchers in those days in the minor leagues, the lights were so bad in some of those parks, and if the guys could throw hard, these guys made it a little tough for them, you know, for the hitters, see.
Do you remember your first night game?
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah, the first night game was in, where the hell was it? Oh, it was in Spokane, and the park was packed, and my first ball game in Western International League, I worked the bases, and the second night, I'm working the plate. I'm working with a guy named Bert Cole. He pitched for Ty Cobb and the Bigs, and the lights in Spokane were very good, so I had no complaints there. Only they all thought, they said, oh, this kid is a rookie. Let's get on him, get all the close ones. He'll give us the close ones if we got him, get on him, so... one night I'm getting a lot of hell, and this is when the season first started, and I said, what the hell is this? I ran into a friend of mine by the name of Penzo on the street. Penzo, am I that bad that these guys are on me? No, he says. We're told by the manager, he says, Goldie Holt was the manager of one of the clubs that was in there, he says, get on this rookie, he says, we might get the close ones. So I said, I'll straighten that thing out then. So the next night I run three of them. From then on, they left me alone. Yeah, that's the way they were. They, of course, depression days, things were tough. People weren't working. They'd go out, instead of giving their wife hell, they'd go out to the ballpark and give the umpire hell, pay 35 or 40 cents for admission, and that's the way it was in those days. They're hungry. Like an animal. An animal in the woods won't eat you unless he's hungry. If he's hungry, he's going to eat you.
You talked a lot about the crowds. How do you feel the crowds were different in those days than maybe today?
Well, the crowds were, well, I'll tell you, they were all different in those days because they didn't have televisions at home. They didn't have radios. They didn't have cars and boats. And now they got everything. They got... in those days, they needed cushions on the seats were a little hard. Now they could buy peanuts for 15 cents. They could buy a hot dog for 15 cents.
Were there as many kids in the ballpark?
Yeah, there was. The kids used to climb over the fence and sneak in, and there were a lot of kids around there. But now, how the hell is a kid going to sneak in? He can't sneak in. And then every now and then, a kid with his dog would take 5 minutes to catch the dog. He'd run all over the field. And you always had a big kick out of a couple of kids climbing over the fence. That's baseball. You don't see that anymore because they can't. How the hell are they going to climb over the fence?
We ever on the bases for a triple play?
Yeah, two or three times, yeah. Yeah, the ball would be a man on first and second. The ball would be hit to the third baseman sharp. Boom, he's step on third. He's right there. He's playing right by the bag, and then second and first.
Do you remember any of the players involved?
Gosh, I don't know. I can't remember any of those guys. No, that's way back, you know. Yeah, I had a triple play in bush ball. It happened just the way, that's usually the way the triple play works.
Yeah. We're going to take a break, turn the tape over.
Yeah.
Once again, it's March 26, 1991. We're here in Seattle and speaking with Johnny Nenezich. You grew up in Seattle.
Yeah.
What was it like? What was baseball like in the days when you grew up? We might as well mention that Johnny is how old now?
82 and going strong. Well, the way it was, the way I got into baseball as an umpire, when I was a kid going to high school, in those days, way back in the 20s, they had all kinds of boxing clubs around, so you could box. You didn't have to train to box, and they had amateur clubs out in our neighborhood, and in the wintertime, it was cold, so us guys would hang around the gym because it was nice and warm in there. The guy had a big stove in there, and once in a while, some of those amateur fighters would want somebody to work out with them, in order to work out, you had to belong to that club. But anyway, the guy that run the club, a guy named Ted Whitman, he was gone, and so one guy wanted somebody to box with him. So I Yeah, I'll box with you a little bit. So I climbed in the ring with my street shoes on, and I worked this guy over pretty good. In the meantime, this guy that owned the club, and he was a fight manager. Hey, kid, you want to box a little bit? I said, no, I don't. Oh, don't you want to make a few bucks? I said, yeah, I'd like to make a few bucks. You want to learn how to box? Yeah. So anyway, I went to school, and the next day I was so excited, I ran about 4 miles from high school to Columbia City where the gym was, and he climbs in the ring with me, this old-timer. He gave me some tennis shoes, and he climbs in the ring, and I go after him pretty good, and he's jabbing me a little bit, and he says, see, what you're doing wrong, he says, you're swinging like a wildcat, he says, in order to cross that ring, you got to go straight, right, to get over there, or would you go around to get over there quicker? Yeah, I got to go straight. So he says, you got to learn to punch straight. So he puts me on the bag to punch straight, and pretty soon he gives me an amateur fight, giving him a Billy O'Donnell. And first he wanted to know what my name was when they put me on this amateur card, and I'm supposed to box this Billy O'Donnell. Well, I knew that I could lick him in parochial school. And he had about four fights, amateur fights. I figured, well, I can lick this kid anyway, what the hell. Even out of the ring, you know, in the ring or out of the ring. So now I'm going to make $1 or $2. I forget what it was. So the announcer, he says, what's your name, kid? And I told him, he says, oh, geez, we got to change that. Then as I told him, he said, oh, we got to change that. He says, from now on, he says, you're Dynamite Johnny Morgan. In those days, back in the 20s, Irish fighters were popular. Even in baseball, the American League, this is what I heard from a pretty good source, would not hire an umpire unless he was an Irish Catholic. This is back in the 20s. Didn't make sense to me, but that's the way it was. This is the way what I heard. So now, anyway, I'm Dynamite Johnny Morgan, and I got a pair of trunks and no jock strap. And there was a couple of girls and their father sitting at the ringside. Their father owned a drugstore, and these girls had lipstick, and they looked cute, you know. And I go to sit down, and she's with no jock strap, and I had a cut right at the crotch there, and I'm embarrassed as hell, so I wouldn't sit down. Before the fight started, I'm standing up, and so I got to get this thing over with right away because I'm embarrassed on account of my shorts, you know. So anyway, I beat Billy O'Donnell very easy. And then I'd had about 10 amateur fights, and I looked pretty good, I guess, because I was a tough kid and a hungry kid. What the hell, a kid that had to wear his sister's shoes to high school a couple of times, you got to be a little, you know, kind of a roughneck, right? Which I was, I guess. So anyway, there was a fighter in his stable that was supposed to fight down in Olympia Pro. His name was Monk Tranis. Hell of a fighter, a lightweight. I was a lightweight in those days. And Monk got a hand infection, and so Ted, he says, by the way, he says, you're ready to turn pro. He's conning me a little bit. And he says, you're going to get paid and make a few bucks. I said, gee, that's fine. So, but you had to go to high school. If you didn't go to high school, they'd call your home, you see, and they'd check on you why you didn't show up. So I went my first period in high school, and Ted picked me up in his Ford, and he, you want to take a buddy with you? Yeah, so I took a kid named Frank Baker that I ran around with. Anyway, I boxed in Olympia, and I got a draw with a guy by the name of Johnny Bray that was supposed to be the champ of the Harbor Country. And this was a special event. Usually when you turn pro, you start as a curtain raiser. And Johnny Bray, here I'm about 16 years old, and Johnny Bray's about 24, 25, cauliflower ear, busted nose, and a real mug. And I'm scared to death, I figure. And this guy, on the posters, they had American Legion Convention down in Olympia, and they were dedicating this new hall. And on the posters it said that I was Dynamite Johnny Morgan, Pacific Coast Amateur Lightweight Champ, making his professional debut. I was champ of nothing, you know. That's the way they conned the public. Bray had won about 6 or 7 in a row by knockouts. He's supposed to be the champ of the Harbor Country, and I'm scared to death, and I'm hungry. So, anyway, the first round, all I'm thinking of is holding on, not getting knocked out. And all of a sudden, this Bray, we're clinching, and he shoves me, "Who the hell told you you could fight?" Shoves me real hard, and I guess I hit the ropes from about here to the chair over there. I hit them pretty hard, and something happened that I threw up my left hand, and he run into it, and down he goes. So I figure, well, I can beat this bum now. So that gave me confidence. So they called the fight a draw, and that's, now they got it in the papers. I make the Frost football team at Franklin, basketball team at Franklin. Now I want to turn out for baseball. Coach says, you boxed on Olympia, didn't you, John? I says, yeah. He says, well, he says, you don't compete in sports in high school anymore. They were very strict in those days. So now I make the ball team and I can't play, and so I keep boxing a little bit. And then I got cut over the right eye up in Canada. And one doctor wanted to take my eye out, and I says, they're talking about glass eyes, you know. Well, he says, we make glass eyes that nobody would know the difference. And I said, no way. He said, well.
They probably thought you'd done that when you became an umpire.
Yeah,
right?
He told my mother, he says, you know, he says, that eye doesn't come out. He says, the other eye is liable to get infected and be totally blind. Well. That's the second eye doctor I went to, Dr. McCoy, in the Swedish clinic. Next day, we're going back on the streetcar to tell him that I wouldn't sit still for it, and I ran into a buddy of mine, Mike McHugh, that I went to parochial school with. Mike had a patch over his eye. Mike, who's your eye doctor? He said, Dr. Bentley, Cobb Building. Mom, we're going to go to Bentley in the Cobb Building. We go to Bentley in the Cobb Building after these other two butchers were treating me for 8 months. 2 days later, my eye cleared up. He says, you don't box anymore. I couldn't compete in high school sports anymore. Played semi-pro baseball, got in a state tournament, I'm not eligible because I was a pro athlete. This is how tough they were in those days. Finally, one of the guys that owned the sporting goods store, he says, Jesus, John, why don't you umpire? We need umpires. Ah, the hell with umpires. I don't like him. I just like to win, you know, hook or crook. And the more I thought of it, I couldn't box anymore. I thought, well, what the hell? I couldn't play ball. So I thought, well, the hell with it. I'll try. He gave me my first assignment. And it was in Bothell, $1. I forget how much we got for our car. I think we got 3 cents a mile for our car. I had an old beat-up Ford at that time, yeah. So... And the following week, he sent me to Edmonds, another dollar, plus 3 cents for my car. That's the way I started. Then I worked my way up from semi-pro to high school, pretty soon college, state tournament, national tournament. Then I was recommended for the WI League, and I thought, oh boy, this is my shot. And there I had a pretty good job driving a pie wagon, $27.50 a week. But I thought, well, Jesus, I'm going to take a shot at pro ball. That's the way I started in baseball, yeah. And I enjoyed it, yeah, especially when I was appointed umpire-in-chief in the WI League. I thought I was God. And boy, if they used to come up to me, and the managers, how do you feel? I don't feel good. He'd go to the dugout and tell his ball player, hey, that son of a bitch don't feel good. Don't even say hello to him. That's the way it was in those days, yeah.
Of all the people that you met in baseball, who do you have the most respect for?
I would say Torchy Torrance. Torchy Torrance just passed away a few months ago, but from here in Seattle, I have more respect for him. And then Bob Brown, that was Mr. Baseball up in Canada. He started baseball up in Canada, and a Notre Dame grad, never missed. Every year he'd go to Notre Dame for a week. Bob, I think, was 90 years old when he passed away. I had a lot of respect for him.
What about players?
Well, some of the players that I had respect for was Bill Lawrence. Dick Geiselman was another great guy. Bobby Belcina. Jack Salveson. Who was the other the outfielder that I called out on this pitch under the went under the plate almost, and he never said a word till the next time he came to the plate and reminded me of it. The big slab, Walter Chudnik, another guy would never hang you. some of those other guys, you couldn't trust them. Don't let them go too far, because they'd hang you. Some of my good friends, Ito Vanni, he'd hang you. Ray Ortega would hang you. These are Coast League ballplayers. Yeah, but I was taught not to trust them with their ball suit on, because they're looking for an alibi. Yeah, those were...
What was your relationship with the press?
Very good, all but Oakland. When I got in that jam down in Oakland, a guy named Red Byron, one of their baseball writers, he said, Mr. Rowland's bartender umpire. Geez, when Rowland read that, he went crazy. He says, you're not a bartender. How did they find out you were a bartender? Well, one of the writers, Bob Foster, one of the announcers down there, he was a Seattle kid, and he didn't know how to spell my name, and I had one of the cards in my pocket. So I give it to him, and I guess in the press box, when they had the big stink down there, he looked over the card, and so that's the way it started. But you see, back in those days, and still today, too, I think, what the hell is wrong with being a bartender? Abraham Lincoln was a bartender at one time. Colonel Rupert, he owns a brewery. He owned the Yankees. Emil Sick, Rainier Beer. Portland, Lucky Lager. What the hell? Somebody got a... Is a bartender a bum or an ex-convict? No way. But Rowland didn't think so. Pants Rowland was the guy that managed Cincinnati, the White Sox when they had the big stink, you know, the Black Sox. He was the manager. And he was our league president. But he was really mad about bartender umpire being in the paper. That was a redhead down in Oakland. Too bad Oakland got beat, you know. So you got to blame somebody. It's like business. Business is good. The boss says we got a good location. When it's bad, we got bad help. That's the way it is. Like the Mariners, when they win, they're going to win. When they lose, what the hell, is something wrong someplace, you know.
What are your impression of the ball players of today and the enormous amounts of money they make?
Well, I tell you, it makes me want to throw up. When every ball player in the big leagues is getting more money than the president of the United States, there's something wrong someplace. Now let's face it. Here's guys. Some of these guys can't even read, and they're getting $1 million, $2 million, and. Who the hell did I read the other day? Getting $4 million for 4 years, $16 million. And here we were struggling. We'd miss meals when we were umpiring, keeping baseball alive. We used to have to bum popcorn and hot dogs at the ballpark so we could stay alive and to umpire to keep the national pastime going. And now look at the umpires today. They're getting a senior man in the bigs, I think, is getting $125,000 a season. A rookie starts out with $40,000, $135 a day for meal money. This is something here. We were getting $90 a month, and we had to pay for our own food, our own equipment, our own hotel. Some of the times we'd sleep in our car. Car would break down. We'd have a hell of a time. Things are different now.
Did you have the feeling from the players that they actually had a real love of the game, or was this, in some respects, a job to them?
Some of them loved the game, and some of them was just a job to them.
Any particulars come to mind?
Well, some of the players that would have played for nothing. QP Dick Barrett was one. Baseball was his life. And he was a hell of a pitcher. I don't know whether you knew of QP Dick Barrett, but he... He was Mr. Seattle for a long, long time. Some of the ball players would never play for nothing. Guys like, let's see, who the hell, Ray Ortega, a catcher for Seattle for many years. That's all he thought of was a buck. Most of them were, well, in the Depression days, those guys had nothing, you see. But that's when they in the minor leagues, so naturally they played ball and made a few bucks, you know, and they were enjoying themselves. They were drinking, and they had a girlfriend in every town, and they were all playboys. They had a lot of fun doing it. Some of them wound up with a few bucks, and some of them wound up but nothing, you know. Baseball, their career, it wasn't too good. Bobby Belsina turned out to be a longshoreman. He was making $100 a day, and on Sundays he'd make $200. What a profession. Dr. Bill Hutchinson, our doctor, he couldn't make the high school ball team. He could have made it, but the high school that he went to, I went to the same high school. There was the wealthy element on one side and then the other side of the tracks. And Dr. Hutchinson, Bill Hutchinson, lived on the other side of the track, lived in Rainier Beach, Bill, John, and Fred. Well, Bill, this guy, the coach at Franklin High School, used these wealthy kids, and they'd bring them presents. And so Bill never made the high school ball team. He goes out to the University of Washington. He was the best ball player that ever came out of the University of Washington. So now he signs in the Coast League. He signed with the San Francisco Missions, $200 a month, which was a lot of money in those days. His dad was pretty smart. Shortstop Joe Carscarrat was playing shortstop for the Missions. This is the Coast League, Triple A. His salary, $75 a month. But his dad thought, well, that's not enough money anyway. This is in the 30s. And he made him quit and go to medical college. So John signed with the St. Louis Browns. That's his brother that just passed away a week ago. Infielder, great infielder, the best ball player of the three brothers, my opinion. My opinion, I think, is pretty good. So anyway, John with the St. Louis Browns, and he was supposed to get a bonus, $5,000, which was a lot of money in the 30s. And then they wanted to farm him out. He wouldn't allow him to farm him out. He said, no, he said, I'm good enough to play on this ball club, and I got to stay here for that $5,000. Well, his dad found out that they weren't going to give him the $5,000, so he made him go back to college. He went to Columbia University, and he became dean of men at California State College. Retired here about 4 months ago, passed away here two weeks ago. And Fred, he was such a feisty kid, he got kicked out of two grade schools. Now imagine getting kicked out of a grade school right in your neighborhood. Out of Emerson Grade School, he got kicked out of Brighton, and I think he graduated from John Muir School, then he went to Franklin. And hell of a pitcher in high school, big. If a kid in high school or in those days, if a guy was big and you'd look at the hitters, which is your size and my size, you look at a big guy and he scares you a little bit. You go, well, this guy's level of dream. He didn't throw too hard in high school, but you look at a little guy and that could throw real hard, you say, well, I can hit this little bum. And that's the way it was in high school. So now right out of high school, when Emil Sick went to the ball club, he was told, now you get two popular kids, he says, that are popular in Seattle. He says that'll draw people. So Freddie Hutchinson from the South End and Ito Venny from the North End. So he signs them both. Ito was an outfielder. He couldn't throw across this room, but he played outfield. And he could hit a little bit, and he could run. He was a great base stealer. Playing right field, he'd have to bounce a ball into second base, almost killed a second baseman Seattle had. But he became popular, and Seattle won the pennant 3 years in a row, and Hutch 1 year won 25 ball games. And they had such a good ball club, I think maybe my mother could have won 25 ball games with that ball club that Seattle had in the Coast League. And the brewery started blossoming. They packed the place out there. People all started drinking Rainier beer. Of course, when they lose, I won't drink the hell with the beer. But they had a winning ball club, and that's the way Amos A. Cut started.
Of course, in those days before the Giants and the Dodgers moved to the West Coast, the Pacific Coast League was almost a major league out here.
It was a good league, yeah. All the ball players that left the big leagues up there always wanted to come out to the coast because that's where the money was. See, that's where they're all getting the big dough.
Do you remember some in particular that came back from the majors and some of the stories they told?
Yeah. Jojo White says he made more money in the Coast League than he ever did in the big leagues. QP Dick Barrett felt the same way. George Archie said he didn't want to go to the big leagues because he was making more money out here. They'd have a contract, and Emil Sick, when they were within, they'd slip them some money under the table. They'd have their contracts, but here's a grand for you, another $5,000 for you. Seattle, they all wanted to come to Seattle because he was making the big dough with the big breweries.
Did they ever tell any stories about their experiences in the big leagues?
Yeah, QP Dick Barrett got an accident up there, and he was telling the story that they wanted to cut off his arm on account of this arm got all smashed to hell, and he said he wouldn't let him. He's going to kill himself if he did. And they wanted then on his arm healed, and he came out here to visit somebody, and he liked Seattle, and they thought he was washed up. So, and then he had a chance to go back there. He wouldn't go back. That was QP Dick Barrett. Speed Jolly, he was a great hitter up there, but he was so dumb, they say that they couldn't hang on to him because he was a boozer also. Some of those stories, but the guys that played out here, they wanted to stay out here because the money was good out here. Baseball.
When you were umpiring, did you ever have thoughts about what you would do as a manager versus what you were doing what the managers were doing at that time?
You mean, would I try to manage a ball club?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I seen some mistakes that they were making. I wouldn't second-guess them, but sometimes we'd all second-guess them. You know, we couldn't figure out why the hell he let a certain hitter hit when he was an automatic out or something. And when he'd leave a guy in there, those guys like Smead Jolly, when he'd get a base hit in the ninth inning and he'd beat the tying run and let him run instead of putting in a runner for him, you know, because I could walk as fast as he could run. Baseball has sure changed. Everybody's bigger now. They're big giants. The equipment is better. Everything is better now for them. Imagine the umpires, when they come to town, they got a limousine, picks them up at the airport. They got the car till their series is over. They stay at the finest hotels in town, like the Edgewater and the new one over in Bellevue. And they got it all going for them. Four umpires. Once in a while, a base umpire doesn't have a call all week. Yeah, they can't talk to them. If you say hello to them, they can kick you out. They do once in a while if they don't like you. The things have changed.
Any impressions of any particular umpires of today?
Do I think of any impressions? You mean the
Say Clemens getting kicked out of the World Series last year, or the playoffs.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
did you think of that?
Well, you see, this is the playoff, and Clemens is popping off, and the whole world is watching it, and he's cussing the umpire a little bit, and nobody hears it, only the umpire. He sees him. What the hell, cuss him right back and let him stay in there. They were hitting him pretty good, and that's why he was hot. I'd let him stay right in there. I wouldn't have kicked him out. The hell, unless he was violent, as he comes up an itch or something, then you got to kick him out. He doesn't kick him out. He kicks himself out. But I wouldn't have kicked him out. No, I'd have stayed right there. You say, well, you're a bum. Well, you're a bum, too. So what the hell? So what the, you know.
We've got a few minutes left. Who were some of the characters that you remember the most from your baseball days?
Oh, let's see, some of the characters. Bill Schuster, the Rooster, they called him. He was a real character, a shortstop for Seattle. Lou Novikoff, an outfielder, that went to the Cubs. He went up and he went back.
How so?
Well, Lou Novikoff, he was the type of a guy that never take batting practice. He'd stay down to a place called Ben Parris's. That was the card room and a bar and a restaurant. He'd drink beer until game time. He'd have a cab waiting for him. He'd get out there in time to put on his suit and play the outfield. They called him the Mad Russian, and he was very popular in Seattle. Schuster the Rooster, I remember one ball game. He comes up to the plate, and the umpire calls a strike on him, and he pulls a cap gun out of his pocket. And the umpire thought it was a real gun, you know. He almost had a heart attack. And, of course, he got kicked out, and he Then he climbed a big screen up there like a monkey. And he was very colorful. Those are some of the characters. Another character was, what the hell was his name? I mentioned him earlier. He went to the bigs. The guy that got in a lot of trouble with women. I can't think of his name now. Yeah, there was a few characters in baseball.
Is there any one particular game, other than some of the ones you've mentioned, that sticks out in your mind?
Well, the one that sticks out in my mind was the Shaughnessy playoff game down in Portland. The 14 innings, and every pitch was crucial, and here I was goofing the night before, and I remember a woman sitting in the grandstand from the plate was from about here to that chair over there, which was, you know, right on top of you. One woman, she says to me, between innings, we'd get back in the shade if we could, because it was real hot that day. If I was married to you, I'd poison you. I said, yeah, if I had a wife like you, I'd take it. I'd shut her up a little bit. And her boyfriend, or whoever he was, she had a nice mink stole on to him on a hot day like that. I'll never forget that one. And then, of course, after the ball game, this guy invited me out to dinner with his girlfriend or his wife, or whoever she was. They were real nice down there. But that's one game that I was worried about because it was my first year in the Coast League. And here I'm goofing the night before, and I was caught goofing in a ball game that every one pitch would have decided the whole works, you know, the Shaughnessy playoff.
Finally, Johnny, how would you like to be remembered as a baseball man?
Well, you know, in what way? I'd like to be remembered the way I was. I was an honest umpire, and I never missed an assignment, and always took care of myself. In baseball, I was taught, when I'm working the plate, to always take a nap in the afternoon, and I did. I always, gives you a little extra. Even if you don't fall asleep, you take a nap for a couple hours, and it gives you a little extra. Working the bases was like a night off to me. And by being that way, but not taking a I'd get in a little trouble once in a while. I'd get a little lazy. I'm looking at some blonde in the third or fourth row or something, you know, and that's when you get in trouble. But working the plate, that was very important to me. I was taught that way, and I really bared down when I was working that plate. I remember one year in the WI League when my partner quit in the middle of the year. He couldn't stand it. The pressure was too much, so I got stuck. I had to work the plate from July 15th until the season was over. Every ball game, I'd have to pick up an umpire in Spokane and one up in Vancouver and one down in Tacoma, and I'm working the plate all the time. I got letter perfect, and I got meaner than hell, too. So, and that was hard work, working the plate, you know, because you got all that pressure. Yeah, things were different, but I would do it all over again. I'm glad my boxing career ended because I knew quite a few fighters that went a little goofy. They're not around anymore, and I'm still around at 82 and still working. And I like my job, I like my people, I get baseball people coming to visit with me. When the Red Sox are in town, if Pesky's with the club, he comes in. Haywood Sullivan brought his whole ball club in here. Palmer comes in to visit. Brooks Robinson comes in. I got their picture on the wall up there. They all come in. I got movie people coming in here. All the coaches from the Angels come in and eat and visit with me. Bobby Knapp and all of them, they're... which I enjoy, you know, that's kind of nice that they come in and say hello to an umpire because most of them hate us. So what?
Bobby Bregan came up.
Bobby Bregan, yeah, he got me a lifetime pass for baseball. And I can go to any park in the country the rest of my life and I can go sit in the press box. I don't like it in the press box, so I go up nice.
Any Bregan stories to tell?
Oh, yeah, Bobby was a catcher. And he belonged to Pittsburgh, and he was managing the Hollywood Stars, Pittsburgh. And one night he was catching. He used to raise a lot of hell with umpires. So, and I saw how he operated.